appreciated the sermon app. Mr. Gerke talked about honesty in one aspect of it, and I actually want to talk about that myself. The Pew Research Center published an article last year. The title kind of caught my eye. It says, Americans Struggle with Truth, Accuracy, and Accountability. And as Pew normally does in their research, it's a pretty detailed survey that they did, a lot of people and a lot of details that came as a result of that. But at that time, they said that about half the adults in the United States believe, quote, made-up news and information. It's a very big problem in the United States today, and about two-thirds say that causes a great deal of confusion about the basic facts of current issues, what's really going on in events. In addition to that, later on they said about 61% of Americans believe that the news media coverage is one-sided and that the news media intentionally ignores stories that are important to the public. So there's been a dramatic drop in trust of the media. And an even larger percentage of adults finds it hard to tell what's true when elected officials speak. Yes, can't believe this, but they don't believe politicians when they speak, right? Yeah, very true. I doubt that's a surprise to you, and probably if that same survey were done today, we would find the numbers even higher for every one of those categories, wouldn't we? And of course, we know God gave a commandment, the ninth commandment, about lying, about being truthful. It's kind of interesting. If you research the ninth commandment, you'll find there are a lot of different views about that commandment. I always thought, growing up in the church, hey, it's real simple, don't lie. Just tell the truth all the time. It's all there is to it. It's what the commandment says. But if you start researching this, you'll find that some people say, no, you know, if you read that commandment, it says you can't give false testimony. It's false testimony. Perjury has to do with court. Can't go into court and give false testimony against your neighbor. Others grab hold of that word neighbor and say, see, it's only your neighbors. You can lie about other people if you want, just not your neighbor. I'm not making it up. Do your research. There are all kinds of ideas. I found one source that quoted what they said was a section out of the Babylonian Talmud. Here's a quote. One is permitted to make a vow to murderers, plunderers, and tax collectors that the produce they wish to seize is teruma, which means it's only to be eaten by the priest. That's sacred. Even if it's not teruma. Or that the property they wish to seize belongs to the royal house, even if it does not. In other words, you're free to lie to them so they don't take your property. And you'll actually find some discussions, again, good old Google, you can find anything you want, right? But you can find discussions online that talk about, well, you know, really, some lives are for the good, you know, and that makes them okay. They're really for the better good. There are scores of documents that want to claim to convince you that little white lies that actually save relationships, that those are really good, that they're helpful, and that they're, as long as it's for the better good, for the greater good, that it's okay. So I'd like to look at the Tenth Commandment today. Let's see what the Bible has to say on this. Shed a little light on some of these items. Is it only about legal settings? Is it only about not lying to someone you would consider a brother, a neighbor, a close, someone of your same faith? And is it okay to say something that's not true if it's being helpful or being nice? We ought to start, I guess, by reading the command. We go to Exodus chapter 20. You find it in Deuteronomy 5 as well. And it says basically the same thing, maybe a slight wording difference here and there, but it's essentially the same statement. Exodus chapter 20, and it's in verse 16. It says, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now, the commandment does use that phrase, false witness, doesn't it? And when you read that, it kind of tends to give that legal sense to it, doesn't it? False witness. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. The Hebrew word that is translated as bear has kind of legal implications to it. The Hebrew word anah, which has as its first meaning, according to Brown Driver Briggs' Hebrew lexicon, to answer, to respond to. So it's like responding to a summons. It kind of has that sound of a legal proceeding. And the same lexicon says the next word means a friend, a fellow citizen, someone that's close to you in that sense. So that seems to lend a little bit of credence to those who think about the courtroom setting, that maybe that's the only thing there is. Now, in case you think I was referencing some outdated sources, here's a quote from Wikipedia. It says, historically, in Jewish tradition, a distinction was made between lying in general and bearing false witness or perjury specifically. On the one hand, bearing false witness or perjury was always prohibited according to the Decalogue's commandment against bearing false witness. Yet, on the other hand, lying in general was acknowledged to be in certain circumstances permissible or even commendable. When it was a white lie, and it was done not under oath, and it was not harmful to somebody else. Now, you might not trust Wikipedia. I got my own issues with Wikipedia at times. Some of the articles I read, it's like, don't believe it. So I take it with a grain of salt. But that statement actually was taken from Chabad.org website under Jewish practice. And it's titled, Telling the Truth and When It's Permissible to Be Less Than Honest. Now, Chabad, it's Chabad.org. Chabad is an Orthodox Jewish Hasidic movement. In fact, they're considered to be the largest, the biggest Orthodox Hasidic movement in the world. And the article tries to support the idea that in certain circumstances it's permissible or even commendable to lie, as long as it doesn't cause harm or death to another person. One of their examples of permissible lying is stated this way. One may, quote, change the truth for reasons of peace. And this article ascribes it to the Talmud. So this is still what's taught in some aspects of Jewish communities. So let's look a little bit. Maybe we could look at some other passages to learn something. Where else can we find false testimony before Exodus 20? Well, if you think about where you might first find that, many of us would probably say Genesis 3. You've got false testimony right there very quickly. Maybe not in a court of law, but you got false testimony, absolutely. You have the serpent coming to Eve and asking her, well, did God say you couldn't eat of all the trees? And her answer in verses 2 and 3 says, we can eat of all the trees, but we can't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know, the day we shall not eat it. Or touch it, she says. I don't know whether that was said or not, but she says it was. Lest you die. And in verse 4, the serpent said to the woman, you will not surely die. For God knows that in the day you eat it, your eyes will be opened and you'll be like God, knowing good and evil. Now, here's God making a statement, and here's the serpent coming along, Satan coming along, and making the exact opposite statement. He gave a different testimony, and he tried to make his version sound better, his version of things to be more accurate by adding some misleading commentary about God being selfish and unwilling to let humans be like him. And see, God's not telling you this, but when you eat this, you're going to be like God. You can decide for yourself what's good and evil. Satan testified to Eve that God's statement was false and misleading. And, of course, he was the one giving the false and misleading testimony. And, of course, it wasn't a courtroom. But then again, in ancient times, legal proceedings quite often were not in a courtroom itself. In ancient Israel, typically it took place in the gate. The elders sat at the gate, and that's where judicial matters were taken care of. And, unfortunately, Eve and Adam believed Satan. And they took of the fruit, and the result was disastrous, as we know. We have another famous example in the book of Genesis. If you turn to Genesis 39, you'll immediately recognize this one. Genesis chapter 39, verse 1 tells us that Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, The officer of an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, bought him, and he was slave to Potiphar. And verse 12 tells us what happened when his wife kept making passes at Joseph. Actually, I guess verse 7, we could start there. Came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph. And she said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, look, my master doesn't know what's with me in the house. He's committed all that he has in my hand. There's no one greater in this house than I. Nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you're his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And so it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. Joseph did his best to avoid this immoral woman and to repulse her advances to him. And of course, verse 12, or verse 11, it happened about this time when Joseph went into the house to do his work and none of the men of the house were inside, that she caught him by the garment, said, lie with me. But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. Wouldn't it be great if all young males had that same character to be able to do that? Wouldn't it be wonderful to flee any kind of sexual immorality instantly? Close, delete any kind of suggestive or pornographic material that pops up on a browser. Just instantly get rid of it. That's what Joseph did. But when he ran out, he left his garment. And, of course, we know the rest of the story. Verse 16, she kept the garment with her till his master came home. And she spoke to him with words like this, or like these, saying, the Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to mock me. So what happened is I lifted up my voice and cried out that he left his garment with me and fled outside. And so it was when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, your servant did to me after this manner, that his anger was aroused. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. Now, this instance really was a legal situation, wasn't it? He was being accused of something, being accused of trying to force his master's wife. And we're not told, I mean, the story is very, very brief here. We're not told whether Joseph protested and said, no, you know, she grabbed me, and I left my coat and ran out. We don't know whether he said that or not, but it didn't matter whether he did or not. The master believed his wife. That's what ended up with Joseph going to prison. It's interesting, isn't it? Sometimes it brings out an interesting point about the truth. Sometimes the truth is perceived as a lie. In this case, if Joseph did protest, whatever he said was not accepted as the truth. Makes me wonder, have you ever had a time when you tried to the very best of your ability to say whatever was actually truthful and people didn't believe you? They thought you were lying? Pretty frustrating when that happens, isn't it? They're convinced that you're not telling the truth. Well, I think we probably all realize the statement in the Ninth Commandment has a lot more to do than just courtroom situations. Really has implications that involve all of our life, all kinds of areas. And how do we know that? Well, there are lots of different ways. First of all, I would say commentaries will state to you very clearly that the command goes far beyond that. It's not just for court appearances. Conservative commentaries, let me qualify that statement. Conservative commentaries will tell you that. No, this is much more broad than that. It's for all parts of everyday life. And the point is that lies are included in this. All kinds of lies. But not just lies, but also things like gossip. And really, if you look at the broader implications of this commandment, it involves anything that is said that is not helpful. Slander, gossip, tale-bearing, backbiting, any form of speech that tarnishes the reputation of someone else is broadly recognized by commentaries as falling under the Ninth Commandment. It's that broad. I found one source that kind of struck me. I hadn't thought of this before, but they said, you know, one of them said, just as the 6th, 7th, and 8th Commandment, which are about murder, about adultery, and about stealing, just like those prohibit harming your neighbor by actions, the 9th Commandment is against harming your neighbor by your speech, whatever you say. And the 10th commandment even goes so far as to say, don't harm your neighbor even in what you think. Don't covet what your neighbor has. So I thought that was kind of an interesting way of looking at it, the progression of actions and then words and then even your thoughts, that the 10 commandments cover those things. Our politicians and our news media today don't seem to see things that way, do they? At least as Pew's survey found out. Now, of course, we don't want to just follow what commentaries say. We want proof from God's Word. And the Bible really is filled with passages that show that this is God's intent. Let's begin with Proverbs chapter 6. Take a look at a couple of passages in the Old Testament and then some in the New Testament. Proverbs chapter 6 to begin with. Proverbs chapter 6, starting in verse 16. Proverbs 6:16, these six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. It says very clearly, God hates lying. No qualifications put on that. No qualification that it's only when it's in perjury, when it's in a court, or when it's in a legal proceeding. God hates lying. He absolutely hates it. He despises it. And when you look at it, you'll see that later on when he talks about being a false witness, yeah, that's included. It's even stated separately down in verse 18 or verse 19. As well as sowing discord among brethren. It's another misuse of the tongue, sowing discord. Boy, we sure saw a lot of that in 1995, didn't we? And some of it again with the church splits over the course of the years that we've gone through. You know, finding the source, going to the source, finding the truth, getting accurate information. Sometimes it's difficult. But God hates lies. He hates falsehood. Period. Proverbs chapter 12, we have another direct statement in the book of Proverbs. Proverbs chapter 12 and verse 22. One sense, it's simply repeating what Proverbs 6 says, but Proverbs 12 and verse 22 says, lying lips are an abomination to the Lord, but those who deal truthfully are his delight. You know, as we heard in the sermonette, it takes honesty, it takes truthfulness to develop trust. And that's what God loves. Those who deal truthfully are his delight, but lying lips, they're an abomination to God. Those are powerful words, very powerful words. Notice in the next chapter, chapter 13 and verse 5, one more passage here in Proverbs. Proverbs 13 verse 5 says, a righteous man hates lying, but a wicked man is loathsome and comes to shame. So God despises a lying tongue that is an abomination to him. He despises lies. And a righteous individual, someone who's trying to be like God, is going to also hate lying. Truthfulness is what's important to an individual who is righteous, man or woman. The Bible in basic English says it this way, the upright man is a hater of false words. Today's English version, another translation says, modern translation says, honest people hate lies. Honest people hate lies. Again, the intent's very clear. God hates all lying, not just in court, but all lying. If we go to the New Testament, notice John chapter 8. Some of you may have already thought of this passage where he talked about Satan. In the context of truth versus lies. John chapter 8, verses 44 and 45. John chapter 8, this was one of the many, many interactions that Jesus had with the religious leaders of the day. Many of the times they got into it. John chapter 8 and verse 44, he says, "You are of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him." When he speaks a lie, he speaks from his own resources, for he is a liar and the father of it. "Because I tell the truth, you do not believe me." When you think about it, that really says about all we need to know about lies, doesn't it? There's Satan. Satan's the source of them. He's the source of that. When he speaks a lie, he's just speaking of his own resources. He's talking about what's the core of him, what his core character is all about. God, in the flesh, says Satan is the source of them. The opposite of that, of course, is truth. There's no truth in Satan, only lies. And interestingly, verse 45 tells us that Jesus points out that Satan lies about the truth. He even lies about truth. Because Jesus said, "I'm telling you the truth. I'm telling you the words of truth. And you don't believe me." Satan is calling it a lie. And he's convinced you that it's a lie. How confusing is that? Well, unfortunately, it's been the fate of people of truth for a long time, that Christians, true Christians, don't get recognized as true Christians. We live in a world that's based on lies, a world of deception, a world of false fronts. It's interesting, some people claim to be fact checkers. Okay, we're going to fact check whoever, what everybody says. But then, who checks the fact checkers to see if the fact checkers are telling the truth? And then who's going to check the checkers of the fact checkers? I mean, it just goes on and on, right? And nobody knows what to believe at times, it seems. Satan has erected an incredible make-believe world where truth is buried. And where people can make evil look good and good look evil. I mean, that's what God said about ancient Israel, right? Isaiah. He talked about that in Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. Every time I read this verse, I think, bingo, here we are. Right back where ancient Israel was. Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. Says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." You know, we're told that Satan has deceived the whole world. Book of Revelation chapter 19, I won't turn there. I think we probably know that verse, or Revelation 12, sorry, verse 9. He's deceived the whole world, and he would desperately love to deceive us, God's people, any way he can. And our children, our teens, our young adults. I'd like to convince them that evil is good. Oh, it's not so bad. Try a little bit of this. Try a little drugs. Get drunk a little bit. Do this, do that. Blend in with the world a little bit. But every time people do that, they pay the penalty. They pay the penalty. Sin always brings about, first of all, the death penalty. And yes, that can be forgiven, but quite often it brings about physical consequences as well. David escaped the death penalty because he repented about his sin with Bathsheba, but boy, did he pay a heavy price in his family life. God's all about truth. In fact, Hebrews chapter 6 tells us that it's impossible for God to lie. Because at his core, just like Satan at his core is all about lies, at God's core, God is all about truth. He's about truthfulness. He's about honesty. In Hebrews chapter 6, I think I read this passage a few weeks back when I talked about hope. And the end of chapter 6 does talk about our hope being an anchor to us. But in Hebrews chapter 6, verses 17 and 18, He says, thus God, determining to show more abundantly to the heirs of promise the immutability of his counsel, confirmed it with an oath. And he's talking about the promise that he made to Abraham. I think I explained that a couple of weeks ago. So he's determined to show the immutability of his counsel. That is, it's unchangeable. You can't change this. This is the way it is. It is set. That by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we might have strong consolation who have fled for refuge to lay hold of the hope set before us. God simply cannot lie. He cannot participate in any falsehoods. It is so much a core value to God, honesty is, that to do anything that would involve a lie or falsehood would be so out of character, it's impossible for him to do it. Look at Paul's instruction to Christians. We're supposed to be putting on Christ. We're supposed to be putting on the attributes of God, the attributes of Jesus Christ. In Ephesians chapter 4, Paul makes a very direct statement about honesty and about putting away lying. And again, there are no parameters given to that. There are no limiting aspects to this, but it's about all lying. Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 20. Ephesians 4 and verse 20, beginning there. He says, but you've not so learned Christ, if indeed you've heard him and have been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning your former conduct the old man, which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lust, and be renewed in the spirit of your mind. You know, God's spirit needs to be renewed. We often talk about that daily. We need that renewal of God's spirit. Asking God for that spirit and ask him to stir that spirit in us. And verse 24, and that you put on the new man which was created according to God in true righteousness and holiness. Therefore, putting away lying, let each one of you speak truth with his neighbor. For we are members of one another. Speak truth with one another. Speak truth. Be truthful in whatever you do. Be honest in whatever you do and whatever you say. Satan wants to sell all of us a pack of lies, and we can't fall for that. We have to realize what he tries to sell is a lie. What God offers us is truth. And we can depend on that. And we can focus on that. If we look at the very last book of the Bible, Revelation, next to the last chapter, chapter 21. Notice at the very end of the book, a very broad statement, again, about lying. Revelation chapter 21, beginning of this chapter, talks about the new heaven and new earth, when God brings his throne to this earth, creates a new heaven, a new earth. First one has passed away. Skip down to verse 7. Revelation 21, verse 7. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the cowardly, the unbelieving, the abominable, the murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone. This is the second death. Again, it's a very broad statement. All liars. But he that overcomes, verse 7 said, will inherit all things. And I will be his God and he will be my son. So all kinds of lies. Again, the Greek word there is a word that just means untrue, deceitful, false, anything that's deceitful or false or lies. Again, it's a very general statement. No reference to testimony in court. Says all liars. Literally, the Greek, if you look at a transliteration of it, it's literally all untruthfulness, all deceitfulness, the false. So God's looking for honesty in us. And it's something we have to work on. You know, obviously, we're as human beings, none of us is instantly like God, like Jesus Christ. We don't have that perfectly. But God is looking for this. It's something we need to be conscious of and striving to build. All right, what about the neighbor thing? I mean, is it okay to deceive people of of other faiths. The Quran says it is. I mean, I don't know if any of you have ever read parts of the Quran, but it very specifically says that you can lie to infidels. Well, that's okay. But, you know, even in the Old Testament, if you remember, God was very specific about dealing with the stranger living among them. They weren't really Israelites, but they'd come to live among you. They'd come to dwell among you. That you treat them well. You don't mistreat them. Remember, you were a slave at one point in Egypt. Don't mistreat the strangers among you. Treat them properly. You're honest with them. You don't lie to them. And we have the parable of the Good Samaritan in the New Testament. Without going through the example of it, I think we remember it. It was a Samaritan, Gentile, that stopped to help a Jewish man who was injured. He was neighborly. That's your neighbor, Jesus said. Who's my neighbor? The man was trying to justify himself. He said, who was neighborly to him? The man, the Samaritan, who acted like a neighbor. So again, the point is, our neighbor is everyone. It's a very general statement. Do good to everyone. In fact, that's what Paul says in Galatians, in the New Testament, Galatians 6. It's true that God does, through Paul, give a little bit of a difference about those who are of the faith, but he says to do good to everyone as we have opportunity, especially the household of faith. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10. He talks about, starting in verse 7, about we sow what we reap. And so honesty, you're going to reap benefits of that. So dishonesty, you're going to reap consequences of that. Verse 10, though, he says, therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. So yes, we have, in that sense, a higher priority, a higher responsibility to our fellow Christians. But he says, do good to all. Do good to everybody. Treat everybody well. Don't treat them evilly. Don't treat them badly. There's no indication from God anywhere that we can oppress or that we can lie to or be false to other people. Should be truthful with them. Now, some people, again, don't think there's anyone here who believes this, but if you ask me something, I just need to blurt out whatever comes to my brain. Now, we need to be careful. What about people fishing for a compliment? You know, sometimes that's the hard part, isn't it? When someone says, well, how's this look on me? You know, you like my new hairdo? You really feel put on the spot when something like that is asked, don't you? Well, you read the Jewish commentaries and say, oh, yeah, lie to them. You'll tell them. It builds them up. It's encouraging to them. Or do you just say, the worst looking thing I've ever seen? Oh, where that dress? You'd do better in a seed sack, a feed sack. No, you don't do that either. I mean, our words are supposed, they have impact, don't they? So our words are supposed to be kind. They're supposed to be kind. Matthew chapter 10, real quickly, look at a couple of passages. I don't think I need to convince anyone of this, but Matthew 10, verse 16. Jesus told the disciples that he was sending them out, but they needed to think about what they were going to experience. Matthew chapter 10 and verse 16, Jesus said, behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Be harmless. It includes what you say, but your actions certainly, but be harmless as doves. So we take a clue from that we ought to think about what we say when we answer somebody. Sometimes it may be a little difficult to figure out what to say. But notice in Proverbs 31. This has always struck me in Proverbs 31. The Proverbs 31 woman that is kind of the ideal that's described here. Proverbs 31 and verse 26 talks about her when she talks, what she says. Proverbs 31 and verse 26. It says, she opens her mouth with wisdom, There's the wise serpent. She's wise. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. It's a law of kindness. She's kind in what she says. Not biting, not sharp, not accusative, but she's kind. We find the same thing, of course, in the New Testament, that we're told our speech, that we are accountable for our words, we are accountable for what we say, and we need to be aware of what we say. I mentioned in my sermon with the virtual teen camp that as an extrovert, it's easy to know what a person's thinking because they tell you. But the proverb also says, in the abundance of words, there lacks not sin. So you sometimes can say too much, and you sometimes can say things you shouldn't say. So you, as an extrovert, got to kind of put a little bridle on that tongue. Don't want to just blurt out whatever comes to my mind. I need to think in terms of the law of kindness. What comes out, yes, needs to be truthful, but also needs to be kind. In Colossians chapter 4, we find the statement in the New Testament that says that when Paul wrote the book of Colossians, the letter to the church in Colossae, Colossians 4, it's found in verse 6. Colossians 4 and verse 6 says, "Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one." Our speech should always be with grace. That's the Greek word charis. It means graciousness. Our speech should be seasoned with that, with graciousness. Thayer's Greek lexicon says, properly, that which affords joy, pleasure, delight, sweetness, charm, loveliness. Gracious speech. So, again, speak truth, but speak it kindly. Speak the law of kindness, as we saw in Proverbs 31:1. So let our speech always, he says, be seasoned with salt. Let your speech always be with grace. So the tongue is a very powerful member of the body. James wrote a lot about that. I won't take the time to go and read some of the book of James, but he talks about the tongue. It has the power of life and death. So we need to be careful with what we say. It needs to be honest, but it also needs to be kind. So the ninth commandment is about truth. It's about honesty. It's about speaking it. It's also about living it. John wrote a lot about truth. He spoke about truth about 22 times in his gospel and another 17 in his three epistles. Let's go to one passage in John 18. John 18, this is at the point when Jesus is on trial. In fact, he is, John chapter 18, he's before Pilate. And Pilate asked him if he was a king. And Jesus said, you've said it, you said correctly. He was honest, he was truthful. And let's pick it up in verse 37 as this exchange kept going. In verse 37, Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" And Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." In other words, people who are truthful, people who value truth, they listen to me. They listen to what I'm saying. They value that. It's important. And Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And having said this, he went out to the Jews and said, "I find no fault in him." Well, I've always wondered, exactly what did Pilate mean by that? What is truth? Was he arguing that there is no such thing as something that's always true, universal truth that never changes? Or was he just talking about how hard it is to figure out what's true? Did they have a problem in the first century with being able to trust what people say? Seems to have been questioning whether there was such a thing as absolute truth, that really existed. But Jesus said, those who are of the truth listen to me. They hear me. they respond because it resonates with them. Truth is important to them. Again, do we love truth? Do we love truthfulness? Our founding fathers, this nation, understood how important truth was. George Washington is quoted as saying this, "I hope I shall always possess firmness and virtue enough to maintain what I consider the most enviable of all titles, the character of an honest man." An honest person. Someone who loves truth and who tries to express truth. Today we live in a world that many realize is fraught with lies and dishonesty, and it can be hard to know what to believe and who to believe. We need to have a love of the truth, both the truth of God and truth and honesty in our lives, our own lives, speaking and living the truth. It's what we see in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. I'd like to close with this passage, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Now, this is a warning about what's going to take place in the end time when a lawless man, lawless one, is going to come on the scene. It's going to be destroyed by Jesus Christ at his coming. So it's very obviously going to take place at the very end of humans' existence or mankind's rule of himself before Christ's return. Verse 9, let's pick it up there. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 9. "The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all signs, our power, signs, and lying wonders." Lying wonders. I mean, again, that's the core value of Lucifer, of Satan, who became Satan. "Lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. And for this reason, God will send them strong delusion, that they should believe the lie, that they all may be condemned who did not believe the truth, but had pleasure in unrighteousness." Again, Satan's all about lies. He's all about deception. He's all about things that are half-truths, which means they're lies. Because if they're not true, they're lies. Those are core qualities that Jesus said come from Satan. He's the father of them. By contrast, God is truthful. He's honest to the core. In fact, he cannot lie. And he's anxious to have others in his family who share that characteristic. That's why it's so important for us to be building that now. So important for us to think about it, to be conscious about being truthful. And with the help of God's Spirit, we can make those attributes a central part of our character, part of our core. I would summarize our duty before God, according to this commandment, in this way. Seek truth, speak truth, live truth. Those are the core, the full essence of God's ninth commandment.